Hello, this week's Bruin podcast is with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Ajay Tyagi, manager of the UTI India Dynamic Equity Fund. It's not intended as investment advice. Ajay is going to give us a run through of some of the features of the Indian market and Indian companies, but bear in mind we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin, and tax legislation and allowances can change, and we may hold any of the securities mentioned. Also, everyone knows India is a huge market, but the size of the middle class opportunity that Ajay describes really took me aback, as you will hear. But obviously, there's no guarantees. There are plenty of risks. So remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase and decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. And with those comments delivered, let's get on with the podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bruin podcast. We're going to be exploring an exciting area of the world, the investment environment in India. And we're in an extremely privileged position to do so because we're joined on this podcast by Ajay Tyagi, who is the manager of the UTI India Dynamic Equity Fund. So, Ajay, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me here.
I think if we just... If we just start sort of right at the top, then most of our listeners are probably not going to be that familiar with the Indian equity market in much detail anyway. So at a very headline level, you know, could you just spell out what are the real opportunities for Indian companies?
Sure. Let's just take a step back and look at the construct of the Indian economy and India's GDP. Approximately 65 to 70% of India's GDP comes from domestic consumption. So essentially, we are a domestic consumption-driven economy. We haven't been too successful in merchandise exports, although we've been fairly successful in our services or services-related exports. But the bedrock of the economy still remains domestic consumption. And I think this is going to be driven by two factors which have held us in good stead over the last two decades, and we feel that they will continue to provide tailwinds for us over the next two decades as well. The first is our demographics. 66% of India's population as we talk is in the working age, which in India is defined as, let's say, between 18 years to 60 years. And the good point is that not only are we young, but we are expected to remain young between now and 2050, as per a United Nations report. We would, in fact, be growing our working age population by 17% between 2020 and 50. Coupled with that is the fact that India's middle class consumption is increasing as per capita incomes are increasing. As of today, we constitute just about 5% of global middle class consumption. But again, it is expected that this will increase to about 40% over the next few decades.
So what was that number? Sorry, 14?
40.
Wow. Okay, sorry, carry on.
Exactly. So these two factors put together, to our mind, will continue to propel India in terms of a very strong domestic consumption related demand. So that will continue to be a bedrock. And that's how we look at the years and the decades ahead for India.
And what kind of consumption is that? Are you seeing the same kind of trends that we've seen in other markets, where in other emerging markets, where a lot of the middle class demand is for kind of Western existing brands, or are there strong domestic brands emerging that specifically cater to that Indian market?
Well, you see, it's a mix of both, actually. But I would just point out here that I think all consumers are aspirational, whether it's India, whether it's the UK, US, any other emerging market. I think as consumers, as individuals, they're all aspirational. We all want to associate ourselves with the best of brands in a particular product category. So yes, as customers move up the ladder, they do want to associate themselves with the best of breed brands. Just to give you an example, maybe You know, when you're just starting off at the bottom, the demand for, let's say, packaged food could be serviced by a local manufacturer or a local brand. But as people move up, have more disposable income, they would want to have, you know, products from a company like Nestle. So clearly the direction obviously is in terms of the best of brand. Now, it's a reality that majority of these brands across different consumption subsectors are witnessing Western brands as the most entrenched and the most aspirational brands. But then there are some local brands as well. And that is why I would say it would remain a mix of both. But ultimately, customers will gravitate towards whatever is the most aspirational brand in that category.
So what kinds of companies really excel in that kind of market then?
I think that's a great question, because this now goes to the real fundamental of generating wealth for our investors. And we've seen over the last three decades, ever since the Indian markets opened up, by which I mean the Indian economy opened up to both domestic capital as well as foreign capital, and equally the markets also opened up to foreign institutional investors, that the best, the most sustainable and the most predictable wealth has been created out of businesses that in some way are connected to India's domestic consumption. It hasn't been out of companies which are operating into, you know, global cyclical sectors, whether it is commodities like aluminium, steel, copper, for that matter, even oil and gas. It also hasn't been from sectors like India's infrastructure sector, where the opportunity is huge, but you see the pricing power is not as much. And I think I'll connect it back to your previous question where, you know, customers are ready to get associated with a brand and in fact pay higher for that brand. Because the brand is the one which they feel is giving them that value, while the underlying product would be the same. Something which is missing in sectors like infrastructure, where there is no pricing power, to that extent, even aviation. And I take these examples because both infrastructure and aviation are high growth sectors, but yet haven't been able to, you know, create sustainable wealth for investors. So the key sectors would be, you know, the entire consumption sector, which you can break up into either consumer staples or consumer discretionary. Interestingly, it will also be the healthcare and the pharmaceutical sector in India. And here, I think the key reason is that Indian consumer or Indian population at large hasn't seen the kind of healthcare coverage which the Western countries or some of the other emerging markets have already seen. The penetration of healthcare in the country is very low. And again, as per capita income is increasing, people are spending on their health. Everybody wants to live healthy. Everybody wants to live long. But I guess the limiting factor is always the disposable income. With increase in disposable income, people are now spending a lot on healthcare, and therefore a few pharmaceutical names and some companies which are on the healthcare providers space, like diagnostic companies, are actually doing very well. And they've created strong moats for themselves. Private sector banks, another category where we've seen strong wealth creation over the decades. And here the story is that, especially on the discretionary side, when the consumers go out and spend, not all of that is spent out of the savings that they have. They do take loans from banks or non-banking financial companies. So financing of the discretionary spend is something which a few retail banks in India have done very, very successfully, but we have still not, I would say we've still barely scratched the surface there. So these are basically the sectors where we would feel that we would continue to get strong businesses and find strong businesses which would create sustainable wealth.
And banks have, in the Western world, in the developed world, banks have just been a difficult place to invest. It's been very difficult for them to make their cost of capital over the last few years. But you would say that that the banking sector is more profitable than in India.
Absolutely, I would say that. And when I say that, I'm just the one metric that I'm looking at here before making that statement is I'm looking at the ROAs of some of the American banks. I'm looking at the ROAs or the return on assets of the European banks, and I'm comparing them with the Indian banks. And I realize that in the US, there are two or three of these banks like the JP Morgans and the Wells Fargo and US Bancorp, which are able to have a reasonably healthy 1 to 1.5% kind of ROAs, which is clearly lacking amongst the best of breed European banks as well. But in the Indian context, the best of breed retail-focused banks make about 2% ROA. Now we can dissect the ROA tree, but I guess a couple of points come out. One, Indian markets are fairly underpenetrated in terms of credit as a percentage of GDP. Household debt or household credit is in the mid-teens as a percentage of GDP, something which is like 40-50% for emerging markets as an average, and in developed markets, the same number could be as high as 70%. So banks in India are not in a hyper-competitive market. They're not competing or competing out each other just on the pricing. Number two, the fairly low interest rates in the Western world are also a reason for the ROAs to be low because their net interest margins are wafer thin. In India, the better managed retail banks still have net interest margins of around 4-5%, which is fairly strong. So I think a couple of these factors put together are working in favor of the Indian banks. It does appear that the runway is fairly long at this stage. It is giving us visibility at least for a couple of decades. Do they go back to the state where the banks in the Western world are after a couple of decades? Possibly yes.
So, okay. And then in terms of healthcare, I mean, does that include sort of healthcare institutions like the hospitals? What's the situation there in India?
Sure. That's a good question again. You're right. Till about 2 decades back, when the Indian economy hadn't opened up, the healthcare sector was clearly, and by here I by this I mean the infrastructure side of healthcare, so which is basically the big hospitals and I would say the insurance and so on. All of that was controlled by the government. The pharmaceutical sector, or the sector which was manufacturing drugs and medicines, was privatized. Of course, we did have a few government companies there, but it was predominantly private sector run, whereas the healthcare infrastructure was predominantly in the hands of the government. That's changed in the last 2 decades. We've seen private participation in hospitals, in diagnostics, in insurance, in medical insurance, that is. And I think that's also led to a fair amount of competition in the market, which has made all of these services, A, affordable, and B, the reach has actually improved drastically. So I think this will continue. We see more and more private sector participation on the healthcare side. Although, from our perspective, since you asked this question, which are the best sectors to ride? From our perspective, we're not so much attracted by businesses which are built around hospitals because it's a high capex model. You have to invest into land, you have to invest into a lot of machinery. All of these things keep changing every 2-3 years, so you have to reinvest into the latest technology and the latest machines. And so it's a low return on capital business and hasn't been as wealth creating as some of the other subsectors within healthcare.
Okay, so but a good vehicle then for the better opportunities within the healthcare sector, but not something that's that provides a good investment opportunity for you.
Exactly.
Okay, well then, what do you look for in a really good investment opportunity? Is there just like a few things that, a few boxes that you need to tick or something like that?
So, let me just quickly walk you through our investment philosophy. Our tenet number one is buy great businesses, by which we mean buy businesses that generate return on capital significantly higher than their cost of capital. If you look at the Indian context, and I'm sure if you look at the Western context as well, the sustainable wealth creators have always come from this pool of companies which have a very high return on capital and have had a track record of persisting on that significantly higher than average return on capital. And it goes back to the core fundamentals of finance, that which is how do companies create value? They create value by generating luscious strings of cash flows and making those cash flows grow into the future like clockwork. And if businesses can do that, they will be generating economic value and in fact growing economic value. And if as investors we can identify these such businesses and hold on to them, then this increase in economic value transfers back to wealth creation for us. So that's our pillar number one. And we never ever compromise on that. And that's why we said infrastructure is a great high growth sector. We stay away from it. Aviation is a high growth sector. We stay away from it. Healthcare we see as a high growth sector, but then there are pockets of healthcare which we don't like, for instance, hospitals, because they don't generate significantly high return on capital and so on. Point number two, we do want these strings of cash flows to keep growing and growing stronger than the market. So if India's nominal GDP is growing at 12-13%, we want our businesses to be to grow at, let's say, 15-20%. So we then have to, again, within this set, figure out businesses which have a long growth runway and to figure out why is it that this strong growth will persist. When we marry these two together, I would say that our portfolio works at the intersection of quality and growth. And if we can remain patient with such businesses, first of all, if we can identify such businesses and then remain patient with them, I think there's a very strong case for sustainable wealth creation.
And is there one risk or a series of big risks? What are the big things that might worry you about the Indian market as a whole?
Sure. I would say two risks. The first one originates from, the reply to your first question, which is that all of us, whether foreign investors or domestic investors, are really looking at India as a high growth country. We can get into the factors of that. We've very briefly discussed some of the factors which are leading to tailwinds for India's growth. But fact remains that if for whatever reason growth doesn't come by, then there is a serious, I would say, then we run the risk of getting into a vicious circle. We have young people who are joining the workforce. Therefore, the government has to provide them employment. If they provide them employment, then we are in a virtuous circle where these people join India's consumption pool. They become part of the middle class. They consume more. Because they consume more, the economy grows more. And then, like I said, it's a beautiful virtuous circle. The big risk is that for whatever reasons, either on account of the policies brought out by the Indian government, or on account of, let's say, capital not being available to Indian businesses because of a global risk off, if any of these things lead to India's growth being, let's say, just about 4% or 5%, then we absolutely upset the apple cart. The number of people graduating out of colleges every year seeking employment would not actually be able to gain employment. And the entire demographic dividend that we talk about doesn't actually come into play at all. So that's risk number one. Risk number two is more exogenous than on account of domestic factors. And this is high global commodity prices. I'm sure you're aware that India actually imports 80% of its crude oil. Apart from crude oil, India is a big importer in many other commodities. And India always benefits when global commodity prices are soft. On the other hand, India actually sees a widening of its current account, increasing inflation, and therefore weakening rupee whenever global commodity prices go through the roof. If we were to have a phase of very strong global commodity prices, it's not good news for India. It's bad news for us. So I think these are the two biggest factors that I always worry about.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask you about inflation. I guess the rupee, the inflation rate, the interest rate, they're all kind of tied together, and they all will seem much more volatile than what we're used to as investors. Is that a risk? Is it an opportunity? How do you incorporate factors like that into your approach, which I know is much more kind of bottom up?
Sure. I think that's a great question. Just to put the record straight first, you're absolutely right. Our inflation and interest rates are high compared to the Western world. And in fact, our currency would also be volatile when you measure it against the US dollar or the euro or the pound. if you were to do the same analysis against emerging market currencies, and I would say take the top 10 emerging markets, the big emerging markets around the world like Brazil, Russia, Mexico, China, Indonesia, South Africa, so on, you would see that consistently over a 30-year period, and we keep looking at those long-range charts, over a 30-year period, the Indian rupee has been one of the least volatile emerging market currencies. In fact, it has consistently been in the bottom decile of volatility. So we're not as volatile as some of the other emerging markets, but of course, yes, more volatile compared to the Western world. When it comes to inflation, I think here is where the track record is a bit mixed. We've had bouts of very strong inflation in the past, and those bouts have coincided with very high global commodity prices, which immediately seep into the economy, and they start leading to inflation moving up. And as a result, the central bank also acting and increasing interest rates in order to cool down the economy and cool down inflation. So yes, we could face such kind of increase in inflation in the future as well. But there's one thing which I also want to bring to your attention, that look, all emerging markets which are going strong, which are growing at 6-7%, would always have their inflation running at a higher level compared to economies which are growing at, let's say, just 1-2%, where inflation is always under control. So part of the reason for high inflation is the high growth. The second part is that India is in the efficiency scale a country which is not as efficient and not as productive as the Western world. As supply chains improve, as economy becomes more productive, we would see less and less shocks coming in from the supply side, which suddenly lead to high inflation. So a well-managed supply side machinery will eventually also lead to inflation numbers coming down. And this is where the good news is. If you track India's inflation over the last 30 years, you would actually, looking at the charts, realize that inflation has actually been coming down from high single digits of 7-8% to maybe around 4-5%. And that's what our estimate is, that we would be somewhere around 4-5% inflation over the next 5-10 years on an average.
And so is that economic efficiency? Is that genuine? You know, is it improving? Is there constant progress against that? I guess that's the sort of, that's where India versus China has not historically been such a flattering comparisons for India. So is there progress in that regard?
Sure. Yes, there is. But if you compare that to China, while China has taken giant leaps and strides over the last two decades in order to improve their productivity, in the Indian context, it's not been as giant. It's been incremental. Part of the reason is that the government has taken a step back. The government feels that there is no business for the government to be in business, and therefore they've opened up all the sectors to private sector. Private sector is very, very focused on productivity and efficiency and return on capital. So as we've seen the role of government in various industries reduce and the private sector actually increase, we've seen efficiency improve in the Indian context. But of course, yes, I'm aware of the fact that the gain in productivity has not been as high as that of China. But we are still working on it, and there's a long, long way to go.
Okay, and progress is being made then. Well,
absolutely.
Let's kind of bring this into a current context. You've mentioned healthcare. You've mentioned airlines as being a competitive sector, and these are obviously both markets which have been really heavily impacted by COVID, and of course all markets have been impacted by COVID. So how are Indian companies dealing with that challenge, which is particularly acute, of course, in India, and also the challenge of just generally weaker global economic growth?
Sure. So I'll have to break it up into two parts. There is a big section of the Indian economy which actually is not perturbed about COVID and its near-term consequences. Of course, the premise here is that all of us feel that things will come back to normalcy in 2021. We'll certainly have a vaccine if not by the end of this year, then by early next year. And therefore, hopefully, by the middle of next year, things do come back to normal. While growth rates may still take some more time to come back to the pre-COVID levels. With that premise, if you break up businesses into two parts, there are businesses which actually haven't got, which haven't been impacted by this virus as much as you know, you would imagine. These are businesses on the healthcare side. These are businesses on the consumer staple side, which haven't been impacted, and businesses, I should say, on the technology and IT services side. So actually, these businesses are not seeing disruption like we would have imagined. Of course, the disruption was there only to the extent of the lockdown period. As lockdowns are getting lifted, they are seeing normalcy return back to their businesses as of, like I can say, as of today, as we speak to them. So we're not worried about such set of businesses. But then equally, there are businesses which are going to have a challenge, not only for the next few quarters, but the challenge could be there over the next couple of years as well. Aviation, hospitality, including hotels and restaurants. These are typically businesses or entertainment and recreation businesses. For instance, India does have a lot of listed companies on the movie theaters and the multiplexes side. Theme parks are also listed in the Indian context. Here we see the challenges persisting for a fairly long period of time. One is that the return of footfalls of consumers coming back to them will be a more elongated process, number one. Number two, usually, because these are high capex businesses, usually these businesses have a very poor balance sheet. Their ability to service the interest has come down and has been challenged because A, these are the businesses which are the worst impacted and in fact are seeing just about 10, 15, 20% of their normal sales. And B, anyway, because of lack of cash on the balance sheet or in fact debt on the balance sheet, they were vulnerable businesses even before COVID. So these are the segment, these are the set of companies and the sectors where we are worried and we are keeping a very close watch on them. How are they reacting? I can just cite a couple of examples. A lot of businesses are looking at retrenchment. For instance, India's biggest airline called IndiGo, a few days back announced that they are laying down or laying off 10% of their workforce. And I think that's the common behavior that we are seeing in these vulnerable businesses across the industries that we discussed.
Yeah. Okay. And I know that you, so we've got to wrap it up now. I think it's been a fascinating conversation, but just to kind of leave us with a nice positive note, you obviously have a buy and hold approach. It's always really interesting to speak to fund managers who are long-term investors because often they can give us a hint at which companies might be the sort of giants of the future. So perhaps you could give an example of a company that you think has got a really great future ahead of it that's in your portfolio.
Sure. Let me talk about a company from the healthcare space. So this is a company called Dr. Lal PathLabs, which is India's largest diagnostics company. Before I talk about that company, I must tell you the construct of the industry. So this industry did not exist in a sense, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. It opened up only in the early 2000s. Before that, if we were to do a diagnostic test, we would have to go to a hospital and people would do that only when, let's say, they were suffering with some disease and the doctor would say that, can you just get these two or three tests done for me? Post 2000, private sector participation led to mushrooming of these diagnostic companies, and you know, the pan-India players opened these diagnostic labs in every nook and corner of the big cities. Of course, now it's happening in the smaller cities as well. And from a concept of going to a diagnostic lab only when you feel that you're having some illness, it's now switched on to basically people going there just to check about their health. So it's very common for people in India, at least in the urban cities or the big cities, to go and do a health checkup done once in 6 months or once in a year. So a new revenue stream has opened up for these guys, apart from these guys taking market share away from hospitals and also doing tests on patients, because they are much more efficient. They have a long list of the number of tests that they can do. And in fact, when you go to a typical hospital today, some of them, or in fact, majority of them will tell you that, why don't you go to this particular lab to get this test done? We trust that report. So a new business model opened up. And given the fact that the penetration of healthcare in India is very poor, but it's surely increasing as disposable income are increasing, this business will continue to remain a high growth business for many decades. The cherry on top of the cake is basically, this is a very high ROC business. Businesses make about 40 to 50% return on capital. In a well-managed diagnostic business can make about 40 to 50% return on capital. Surely the name that I spoke to you about does make about 50% return on capital, even higher than that. So I think strong growth, strong quality, moats in terms of the fact that if you actually establish yourself as a player who actually gives accurate reports, then these are the sustainable moats for you in the future as well. So that's the example of a typical business that excites us, and we love to buy and hold such businesses. Yeah.
Okay, well, Ajay Tyagi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk us through that. I hope all our listeners enjoyed learning a bit more about a market we don't know that much about compared to some of the bigger Western markets that we talk about quite frequently. Obviously, India has great potential growth ahead of it, so hopefully you found that useful, and we really hope that you'll also join us for the next Bruin podcast as well. Thanks for listening.